Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. This is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and also founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
So, Sam, the Mueller report is out. It is being discussed. Congress has been deciding what steps to take. There are ongoing hearings and investigations. Attorney General Bill Barr had been called before the Senate to talk about the report, and much more is to come, including possible testimony by Mueller himself. And so we thought we'd spend a little time setting up a little bit of a book club, as you've called it, and
yes,
taking a deep dive into this report with some of the best experts in the field to help walk us through both the two main sections of the report, as well as some of the aftermath of the report, including the way the Attorney General has handled it. And so we're hoping that this provides a primer for what we know and what might come next. So why don't we get started with the first section of the report, which hones in on the interaction between Trump campaign officials and officials who have connections to the Russian government.
And that would be in the domain of collusion, is what people have been calling into the news.
Exactly. And for this discussion, we have with us Marcy Wheeler. Marcy Wheeler is an independent journalist writing about national security and civil liberties. She writes at Empty Wheel, which is her blog, and she publishes on many other outlets, including Motherboard, The New Republic, and Al Jazeera, and appears frequently on television and radio. Marcy also serves on the advisory committee for the House Fourth Amendment Caucus, is a senior fellow at GWU's Center for Cyber and Homeland Security, and was declared an Internet Human Rights Hero by Access Now. She has been blogging full-time since 2007 and has a PhD from the University of Michigan. So maybe we can just start with what a reader should be looking for in the first section of the report, and more important, what Mueller was looking for as he put that together in terms of what is conspiracy, collusion. What is this whole first section about?
And this is just volume one we're talking about, right?
Right. So volume one assesses whether or not there was a conspiracy between Trump's associates and the Russian government on its election interference activities. And a bunch of things are not included in that. One is a couple different places in volume one, Mueller says, I'm not talking about collusion here, I'm talking about conspiracy or coordination. That's on back in March 2017, Jim Comey made it clear that no FBI investigation was going to hunt for collusion because it's not a crime. But nevertheless, everyone on both sides of this issue, all sides of this issue for the last 2 years have been saying collusion, 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 collusion. Right at the beginning of this report, Mueller says, I'm not talking about collusion, I'm talking about conspiracy or coordination.
Is that just hair splitting? Because it seems to me that there's a phrase in here, conspiracy to defraud the United States. And what else does collusion mean but working together to defraud the United States?
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, remember, too, that he's only looking for conspiracy between Trump associates and the Russian government.
Okay.
So, for example, though much of it is redacted, there is still new information about Roger Stone's success at optimizing, or at least learning about what WikiLeaks was going to drop. They did, in fact, learn that Podesta's emails were going to drop. And that's not the Russian government. So there is substantial evidence, both in Roger Stone's indictment and in this report, that not only did Roger Stone manage to coordinate with WikiLeaks, manage to optimize the release of these stolen emails, but he did so on the order of Trump campaign officials, and he did so checking in repeatedly with Trump himself. So that would seem to fit the garden variety definition of collusion. But it's not a crime because of the First Amendment considerations involving WikiLeaks. Mueller also appears to have considered the WikiLeaks releases as a campaign donation, as a foreign campaign donation to the campaign, and again, for First Amendment reasons and a bunch of other stuff that's redacted, not charge that as an illegal campaign donation from a foreigner.
Okay, so the idea is that this is a very limited inquiry into contacts between the Trump campaign and the Russian government to commit conspiracy, and that was the question that Mueller focused on. Is that right?
Right, and he, you know, he in a couple of different places, he makes it clear that what he found was, quote, two parties taking actions that were informed by or responsive to the other's actions or interests. In other words, you know, the Trump people knew that Russia was helping them, and they tried to make the most of Russia helping them, going so far as to having a campaign plan for the WikiLeaks releases. And Russia knew that Trump knew that, and they, in turn, were following what Trump was doing and trying to help them as much as they could without any specific conversations of coordination. Again, since there is no one definition for collusion, that might meet some people's definition of collusion, and we're stuck arguing about collusion until, you know, the cows come home. But that is what he showed with regards to Trump's awareness of and welcoming of the Russian operation.
Is there nothing? So the kind of conspiracy he is was looking for, Mueller, is illegal. Doesn't find that. Is there anything in between illegal and totally kosher in the law, or is it just politically not good what you find in the first section, if that makes sense?
Well, I should also say that when he described those campaign finance crimes, mm-hmm. Being both the June 9th meeting where Don Jr. says, you know, if it's what you say, I love it, especially later in the summer, and the WikiLeaks optimization, at one point he says that there wasn't enough evidence to charge and sustain a prosecution. So it's not even that he claims no crime happened with the campaign finance stuff. He just claims that, you know, once you throw very good lawyers at this campaign finance question, you're not going to get a conviction, and you can't charge the president's son if you're not going to actually get a conviction of him. So he's not even saying there was no crime. He's saying mm-hmm. there was no crime that can be charged according to the prosecution manual.
Okay, so that's the campaign finance section, and that's actually at some level, I think, doesn't that get us into pretty late here? I was reading about campaign finance on page 183 of this first volume. I do want to go back to the meat of the report, but this campaign finance thing is a sort of an interesting sidebar. So as you just said, Mueller says, we're not going to go after campaign finance, but it seemed to me to be, that's a judgment call, because I was reading that Bob Bauer has written that it's ridiculous. He didn't put it this way, but he appeared to be somewhat dismissive of the idea that you couldn't put value on facts that were dug up in opposition, like of course that has value. And now Bauer is a campaign finance guy, and so he understands this. Was this a purposeful way to cut off what Mueller thought would be a fruitless investigation?
No, I mean, and I got to say, Cory Booker made an even better point during the Barr hearing the other day, where he said this kind of coordination, this kind of conversation back and forth would be illegal between a super PAC and a campaign. But because, and he in this case was talking about Manafort and Konstantin Kilimnik, but because it was with a foreign government, with somebody who is a suspected Russian, somebody with ties to Russian intelligence, somehow that doesn't get charged. You know, I think that that's another very good critique of Mueller's charging decisions, that the standard for coordination he used with this stuff may have been too loose. But look, I mean, if you're talking about charging the president's son or the president's lifelong political advisor, you really do need to have something like 90% confidence that you're going to get a conviction. In the case of Roger Stone, much easier to take what's a slam dunk obstruction and false statements and witness tampering case, which might have the same kind of criminal penalty, and will expose if it finally goes to trial, exposes the same kind of involvement of Trump's campaign without, I think, the legal uncertainties of having to go after the president's son with some untested legal theories.
And then I'm looking now, I'm using the hardbound report, and in the page, in the 130s of the document, there's discussion of the big economic transaction that emerged in the press and is in this report, which is the Trump-Moscow project. What do we learn from the report about how that played out, not just during the campaign, but after the campaign was over? What did Mueller find out about that?
So this is a deal that Michael Cohen started pushing in 2015 with Felix Sater. Felix Sater, in December 2015, tied this deal for a Trump Tower in Moscow to Trump winning the presidency, bizarrely. I still don't understand that. And when Congress started investigating Trump's ties to Russia, everyone sort of agreed we have to maintain the fiction that Trump had no business ties to Russia. And so Michael Cohen, in consultation with Trump's lawyers and Don Jr.'s lawyers, put together a story that made this Trump Tower deal less damning than it otherwise would be. He basically invented a story that ended the pursuit of this Trump Tower deal before the Iowa caucus, rather than continuing through at least June of 2016. And we should talk about the counterintelligence side, which is not in this report, but one of the things that the report does show is the people that Cohen was working with on that deal were even more incriminating than we knew from abundant reporting, largely on the part of BuzzFeed, which got all of these documents about the letter of intent on the Trump Tower deal. Not only did Don Jr. and Trump believe that they stood to make $300 million off of this deal, which they were pursuing in the middle of a presidential election, but they were willing to work with somebody who was indicted in the United States for fraud. The BuzzFeed reporting makes it clear that Cohen was working with people who have ties to GRU, the same intelligence agency that was at the time hacking Hillary Clinton. Cohen knew that he needed Putin's okay to get this deal going. And so that's what he was doing in the spring of 2016 as Trump was running for president and claiming to have no ties with Russia, was trying to get people close to Putin to approve of this deal. And then finally, the way in which Sater set it up, and I think this was intended to be really damning, it involved two sanctioned banks. So to pull off this $300 million real estate deal, Trump's company would have had to work with, in one case, a deal that was sanctioned under the Crimea sanction, so especially toxic at the time. And that didn't stop them from pursuing this deal, at least through June 2016. So I think that's the import of that deal, is it shows that Trump was lying about his ties to Russia, but it also shows that Russia had something over Trump. Russia had this discussion about this deal, which was not just proof that Trump was lying about his ties to Russia, but also proof that Trump and Michael Cohen were willing to really do fairly scandalous things to pursue this $300 million too good to be true real estate deal in Russia, even while he was running for president.
And this comes to explain why Trump has been so eager to keep quiet the things that to slow down or stop this investigation along the way, or could there be more things that are that he's trying to keep quiet?
Well, Mueller, I mean, I think you guys are going to get to this later on, but Mueller says there are multiple possible theories. One is Trump may have assumed that the June 9th meeting, the WikiLeaks optimization, Paul Manafort's communications with Konstantin Kilimnik, if he knew about them, he may have assumed those would be deemed criminal and therefore wanted to prevent the disclosure of those things. There's no reason, sanctions violations aside, there's no reason to believe a real estate deal in and of itself is illegal, but it's really embarrassing, and it proves that he was lying, and it proves that Michael Cohen, when he testified to Congress, basically said Trump was trying to use running for president as a branding and profit-making pursuit, and the Trump Tower deal is part of that. It shows that at the beginning of this whole running for president thing, Trump was interested in making money off of it. It wasn't, any interest in serving the country. I will say, again, the scope of this is Trump associates, Russian government, election interference. Something that's left out of that, and we don't know whether there's a there. There's reason to believe there may be a there. What's left out of that is graft. What's left out of that is financial business deals, particularly in the transition period, that might be unrelated to the hack and leak of the election, but may in different ways compromise Trump or his family or people close to him in fairly interesting business deals, either with Russia or with other entities. There are still ongoing aspects to this investigation, and one of those is what is commonly called as the mystery appellant, which is a foreign-owned company, which doesn't want to provide evidence to the U.S. government and said, you can't make me respond to a subpoena. The only punishment you can do is presidentially imposed sanctions because I'm a foreign-owned company. And that's the kind of thing that wouldn't be related to election interference, but might be related to that kind of graft. And again, Mueller kind of pretty explicitly brackets off this investigation as dealing just with election interference.
Which was a lot by itself. I mean, just to kind of, this is going to be terrible. This is sort of like a crazy book club where I should say, by the way, that Julian texted me that he can hear pages turning over here in the studio. And my reaction is, well, man, it's a book club. I mean, like, I got this big
That's
book.
Fair. That's fair.
You know, it just came in my inbox from, you know, the Washington Post, and they published it. It's this, like, satisfying thing that looks like a world almanac from my childhood. So just to dispose with, I mean, it's weird because there's a whole 100 pages of this report, basically section Roman numeral 4, which is Russian government links to and contacts with the Trump campaign. And, Marcy, what you're basically saying is, okay, so Mueller restricted himself to certain topics, and yet there's this giant section on that topic, right? It's and then it's all, got all these blacked out things, which I presume are what, like spun off investigations or counterintelligence investigations that other parts of FBI are taking care of. It seems like this was already quite fruitful, even without getting into graft and financial misdealings. Is that right?
Yeah, and there are aspects of those contacts with Russians that were not previously known. So there was another Trump Tower deal, one of the ones that Michael Cohen believed involved an Olympic wrestler involved somebody much closer to Putin. The deputy prime minister was in contact with Trump, and Trump's answers on that contact don't make any sense. That's one of the areas where his responses to Mueller was downright contemptuous. There was basically Petter Avin, who is the head of Alpha Bank, describes how immediately after the election, Putin sent all of his oligarchs off to go, you know, make these ties with the Trump administration. Avin was not that successful, but Kirill Dmitriev, who we knew was kind of in the loop, was successful. I mean, he was literally planning the first call between Trump and Putin less than an hour before the call happened via a hedge fund who is friends with Jared Kushner. So, you know, this is crazy, but rather than having a functional White House, what we had was a Russian oligarch and Jared's hedge fund friend planning out how the terms of Russian American detente between Putin and Trump. That's not election interference. And that's something that I think deserves a lot more attention. That's a new disclosure in this report. And then you mentioned the referred investigations. There are 14 of them, and we kind of know what some of them are, but we don't know what a lot of them are. And those, you know, in the past, we've known that they pertain to things that don't have to do with election interference, don't have to do with Russian election interference. We know, for example, there's a case that Paul Manafort was lying about that involved another attempt to save Trump's election campaign. We don't know who, we don't know what the circumstances are, but it was another attempt in August 2016 that may be criminal, that is being investigated by DOJ, which would be a referral because it's not Russian interference, it's some other kind of illegal interference. So, or graft. We know that there's an investigation into the inauguration committee, some of which came from SDNY, from the Southern District of New York by itself, but some of that was referred by Mueller. Doesn't have to do with election interference, but it does have to do with Trump's alleged attempt to monetize running for president. So that's the kind of stuff that may still be out there.
And what? So you brought him up, but Paul Manafort clearly is one of the most visible figures for a lot of the public in terms of the investigation. And his kind of work and the problems he brought. What do we learn about him from the Mueller report that we didn't know before in terms of his involvement, his role in all this as campaign chair?
Well, we had always, as part of his breach determination, so he was allegedly cooperating with Mueller starting in September of last year. And just after the election, Mueller said, actually, you didn't really cooperate. And so we're going to declare you in breach and you're not going to get any consideration in sentencing. And there was a multiple month-long determination of to what degree he wasn't cooperating. And we learned that one of the things he lied about was what he was doing with Konstantin Kilimnik. Now, Kilimnik is a longtime business partner of Manafort, but the FBI says, and Rick Gates says, and another one of their former colleagues says, this guy is either a Russian spy or has ties to Russian spies. So that's one issue, which is that this is somebody that Manafort was directly working with that the FBI believes has ties to Russian intelligence. We knew from the breach determination that Manafort was sharing polling data, private polling data with Kilimnik. The report shows that that continued from spring, April or May, through the time Rick Gates kind of lost his mojo on the campaign. So even after Manafort was fired in August, we also learn that at a meeting where Kilimnik and Manafort talked about how to get back on the gravy train with these Ukrainian oligarchs who had been making them rich, and also with Oleg Deripaska, who's a really key player in all of this, how to get back on their gravy train. At that meeting, they discussed one Ukrainian quote-unquote peace deal, which basically involved carving up Ukraine so that Russia got what they wanted, which both sides agreed had to involve Trump's assent to make it happen. So in other words, Kilimnik was basically like, help me carve up Ukraine by getting Trump to do it. And at the same meeting, this is August 2nd, 2016, Manafort basically laid out for Kilimnik, who of course had worked campaigns with him, so knew how he worked campaigns, he laid out how he was going to win the states he ended up winning the election in. He walked him through
with
how he
data.
Was going to win. Not just polling data, apparently. I mean, again, this is something that we learned new in the report, is he was laying out their strategy to win Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. That's where Trump won. And that's an area where it's clear the obstruction made a difference in the investigation. A judge found that Manafort lied about that meeting. And Mueller's conclusion on those issues is we were never able to figure out precisely what was going on. The polling data went into Konstantin Kilimnik's hands, and we don't know how Russia used it. We can't prove that Manafort was giving that to Kilimnik so he could give it to other people in Russia so that they could be more effective in their efforts to get Trump elected. But also, in the breach determination, Andrew Weissman, one of Mueller's prosecutors, was very explicit. He's like, we think that Manafort lied about this because if he didn't, it would ruin any chance he had of getting a pardon. And one of the things that Mueller alleged Trump had done to obstruct the investigation was to keep floating pardons to all these people, including Manafort. So that is, I think, the clearest case where you can show an effect of an action that Trump took to obstruct the investigation. And that is this really scandalous thing. You know, like, and again, this Cory Booker made that great point. Had Paul Manafort shared that same polling data and that same information about how they were going to win Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania with super PAC supporting Trump, it would have been a clear-cut campaign finance violation. But because he was sharing it with a guy believed to have ties to the same intelligence agency that was still hacking the Democrats, somehow it's not a crime. And that's where we end up. And the reason he lied about that, according to the prosecutors, they think, is because he was still hoping to make Trump happy and get a pardon.
And then another really interesting section that probably most people were not familiar with and are still not familiar with is on page 209 when we reach Eric Prince and his meeting with someone named Dmitriev, who I think headed a government-owned investment fund, Russian investment fund, if I'm correct.
So that's Eric Prince, CEO of Blackwater, I guess.
Yeah. What was that meeting all about? And what do we learn about it in the report?
Well, so that's this guy, Kirill Dmitriev. He runs Russia's sovereign wealth fund.
And this is page 151 of the original release. Sorry, go on.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so Kirill Dmitriev is one of these oligarchs who immediately, like literally the day after the election, is like, I'm getting on a plane so I can start meeting with Trump people. No need to rush this, but, you know, I'm hopping on a plane today.
No rush.
And he is using various means to try to get an entree to the Trump campaign. And he went through both George Nader, whom we knew about. George Nader is this guy who's got ties to the Emirates and a bunch of other Gulf nations. He, I think, got immunity to cooperate with Mueller and described some of this. But Dmitriev also went through, as I said, Jared Kushner's hedge fund buddy, Rick Gerson. So he had two means of getting through to Eric Prince and other people in the administration. And what Eric Prince testified to the House Intelligence Committee is he was just happened to be on the Seychelles, and this Russian just happened to end up there, and they happened to have a beer. But in fact,
you know, that's always happening to me. I'm just in the Seychelles, and there's like some oligarch, and you know, why not have a beer?
Why not have a beer?
sorry, go
but
on.
But what the new details in the report are that Eric Prince knew he was having this meeting. He was in contact with Steve Bannon. He had two meetings with Dmitriev, one about this plan, this detente, basically, to plan between Russia and the United States. But the second one, while he was in the Seychelles, Russia was moving in on Libya, and he demanded another meeting and said, you know, you have to back off Libya, which, whatever else it is a testament to the fact that Prince believed he could represent the interests of the administration, although he said to the contrary. This is another area where there's clear presumed obstruction, because Prince was texting back and forth. Phone records show that he and Steve Bannon were texting back and forth about this meeting, but that when Mueller came and asked them for those texts and looked at their phones, neither one of them still had them on their phones. So yeah, that's an instance where what really the communications going on between Bannon and Prince went down the memory hole, and we probably won't learn the full scope of what was going on there.
Right. In the executive summary here on page 10, and of course elsewhere towards the conclusion of volume one, Mueller's people conclude that there was to paraphrase, pretty successful job of suppressing or destroying evidence, that they were basically stymied in getting to the bottom of a lot of these things because of successful destruction of evidence, such as these, I guess, these encrypted text messages, I suppose, that were destroyed. Is that right?
Right. Yeah. So, yeah, and I mean, another example of that is Rick Gates, when he was sending polling data to Kilimnik, had on Manafort's instruction, he was sending it on unencrypted chats and then deleting the chats on a daily basis. So those don't exist for anyone to investigate.
Now, this whole section here with Prince and Dmitriev in the report is just littered with redactions. And so, and it all says grand jury. So when I encounter something in the text that says grand jury redaction, does that mean that there's an ongoing investigation, or does that mean that there's something confidential that would be, like, what is a naive reader to make of these big black rectangles that say grand jury?
The grand jury ones are probably innocuous, with two very specific exceptions. The grand jury ones just mean they're telling what somebody personally told the grand jury, or what legal process was used that required a grand jury subpoena. So virtually all of the grand jury redactions, I would say, are not suspect. The exceptions to that are in discussions of why both Trump Sr. and Trump Jr. did not testify. There's a grand jury redaction, which particularly in the case of Don Jr. and possibly in the case of Don Sr., say, we were going to subpoena him, but his lawyer said he was going to invoke the Fifth Amendment, and so we didn't subpoena him. First of all, that doesn't seem to be a grand jury issue, but also it seems that if the president and his son refuse to cooperate in this investigation and the attorney general hides that by claiming it is sensitive grand jury information, that seems like a real political problem. So that's one thing. There are two other kinds of there are three other kinds of redactions. One is investigative technique. That's sources and methods. That's unsurprising and not suspect and probably all came from FBI. Another one is personal privacy, and this is a bit suspect. It when Mueller discussed these redactions in his letter to Barr, complaining about how Barr was dealing with the report, he described that redaction as declination's decision. So, for example, we know that Katie McFarlane, when she was first interviewed by the FBI, lied about this sanctions call with Sergei Kislyak on December 29th, 2016. And then after Mike Flynn flipped, she kind of fixed her testimony sufficient that she did not get charged with false statements. And so there must be a passage in there where Mueller describes there are actually three Trump people, four actually, there are three Trump people where Mueller describes how they avoided false statements charges. This is on page 199. And then there is potentially a fourth on page 194 where he describes what would be perjury. Those are all people who lied to the investigators, but because they were not charged, the discussion of why they were not charged.
Oh, God, 199, it's like a giant redaction.
Yeah, that seems right. To be three different people who lied to investigators and managed to get away with it because they cleaned up their testimony.
Yeah.
And that's appropriate. It's appropriate that when someone is not charged, that that we don't get to see that. Although
because they can't stick up for themselves because they're not going to get a day in court. So is that the idea?
Right. Although, interestingly, Barr did not choose to redact the declination decision regarding Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions was investigated for lying to Congress in his confirmation hearing. That didn't get redacted. So there's inconsistency even on the declinations decision side. But what I find suspect about these redactions is not that they happen. I think they're appropriate. But that Barr testified to Congress that they are, he said, a couple different times in a couple, you know, his letters, his press conference, he said these were peripheral people. They're not peripheral people. There's one.
Like one of them is KT McFarland.
One is KT McFarland. One is Don Jr. One hides the fact that Don Jr. came under investigation.
He always liked Ivanka better.
Right, right. But I mean, hiding the fact that Don Jr., that there was a predicated investigation against the president's son, that's, you know, that may be appropriate or not, but that is not a peripheral person by
I
any
see.
Shape.
So the idea is that here we have the fingerprints of Attorney General Barr, in which some of these things are, let's say, in the case of the grand jury, if I understand this correctly, that's redacted because, I don't know, if Congress wanted to look into it, they'd have to maybe redo the work somehow. Methods are to basically protect sources or methods or keep people from getting killed who were sources. But here the personal privacy is the fingerprints of Attorney General Barr. And it's inconsistent, right? He doesn't like Sessions, and so therefore Sessions gets
shipped.
Well,
he does like Sessions. I mean, you know, to be fair, Sessions was accused of lying to Congress, and the government decided to give us an explanation that those lies were not deemed sufficiently material to his confirmation process. So I get why they left it, but it is inconsistent. The declinations decisions are inconsistently applied. But more importantly, the notion that these are peripheral people is rank nonsense, and Barr should get some heat for that. There's one other redaction which may or may not be suspect, and that is harm to ongoing matter. A ton of those are about to one degree the Internet Research Agency case, which Concord Management is contesting in court, and therefore
Who's Concord Management?
Concord Management is a company owned by an oligarch named Yevgeny Prigozhin, who, you know, often called Putin's chef. And he's the guy who ran the troll companies. And Concord Management is one of the companies that he was laundering money through, allegedly, to pay for the trolls. So that is a charged defendant who is contesting their prosecution. And so some of that is redacted. But the by far the biggest amount of harm to ongoing matter stuff involves WikiLeaks and Roger Stone, especially because Roger Stone, his trial is not until November. And in the D.C. district, lawyers on both sides of the case are not supposed to comment publicly in a way that might impact the case. There's a gag on the lawyers in those cases. And so it happens that because of that gag order, a lot of stuff that would be really damning to the president ends up being completely redacted here to protect, rightly, Roger Stone's right to a fair trial. And so, you know, by far the largest amount of redactions under harm to ongoing matters have to do with Roger Stone's efforts and success to some degree at optimizing the WikiLeaks releases.
Let me, on this topic of troll companies, there's a whole section we just flew right over. We didn't even spend any time on it, and time's short, but I just wanted to flag it, which is in this whole section about Russian government links to the Trump campaign, there's something here that's not quite illegal, but it seems to reveal some serious weakness in our political culture, where these troll companies had a really easy time getting people like Kellyanne Conway, Donald Trump Jr., and so on to basically retweet and repeat things. Stuff like miners, I can't find the page number right now, but like miners for Trump, like miners as in like coal miners. And also a fake troll account called TEN_GOP. And this is purportedly Tennessee Republicans, but it turns out to be just basically a little disinformation farm. And here's Conway, Donald Trump Jr., others, just, and, you know, real Donald Trump himself, repeating all this information and putting it out. So what are we learning about our political culture from the fact that these Russian operatives were able to just come right in and do this?
Yeah, and I want to add 2 points about that. One is it's not just retweeting tweets that they got Americans to do. There were 3 Trump campaign officials who were interacting with these trolls. There were Trump volunteers who were interacting with these trolls. There were also left-wing people. The trolls went after alleged African-American rights groups, went after Bernie Sanders supporters. So it is not a partisan issue that these trolls went after Americans and tried to get them to take action in part by hiding who they were and what their actual motive is. And that's an area. And then one of my most favorite redactions is on page 30. That describes, quote, dozens of actual events, actual protests or rallies or what have you.
Page 30 is just a black rectangle.
It's entirely black.
Okay, go on.
And we knew that there were, you know, we knew from the indictment, which was February 2018, we knew that these trolls had succeeded, for example, in hiring somebody in Florida to build a cage for a, you know, jail Hillary stunt for a Florida rally. But what this black page presumably describes is that they did this over and over and over again. Dozens of times they said that these trolls sitting in St. Petersburg were able to get Americans of all political stripes to go out into the street and weigh in. Now, that doesn't mean that the motives of those Americans is any less heartfelt. Like, these people supported Trump. These people supported African-American rights. These people supported Bernie Sanders, right? And that is their legitimate political view, whether or not you agree with it. But what these trolls in Russia were able to do was magnify the divisions in our politics by hiding who they were and hiding what their, they do care. They wanted Trump elected. But beyond that, they care more about increasing the divisiveness in American politics. And that big black page on page 30 describes how successful they were at that.
If someone hasn't read this report and has been following it a bit in the news, what is there one part of it, one story, one section in that first part that you would point them to that for you captures the essence of what Mueller found in terms of this extensive interaction that existed?
Well, I think it'd be the Manafort stuff because he wasn't able to determine what it was. And it was a clear-cut case where his campaign manager, at a time where everyone else on the campaign had been told, you know, eliminate all contact with Russians, the campaign manager and his deputy snuck into a cigar bar and at the same meeting talked about how to win Michigan, how to get paid by foreign oligarchs, and how to carve up Ukraine. And we still don't know what that meeting was about, in part because of the obstruction of justice that the second half of the report describes. But on its face, it's still unbelievably damning that the campaign manager at a time, remember, he was working for free at a time, you know, like his best motive for doing this is because he wanted to get paid by these oligarchs at a time he's working for free, took time away from the campaign to go tell a foreigner how he was going to win Michigan. I mind about that because
you're from Michigan. You're in Michigan.
I'm in Michigan now, and it really pisses me off that he sold us off to carve up Ukraine, which is what it looks like if you're sitting here in Michigan. But that's what he did, right?
Yeah.
How to win Michigan, how to carve up Ukraine, how to get paid by a bunch of oligarchs. That's what happened at that meeting. The only reason he had to get paid by the oligarchs is because Donald Trump wasn't paying him.
And I've got the searchable PDF of this, and I just found that on page 140. When we release this, we'll send out the searchable PDF that you sent us so we can find this trading of Michigan for Ukraine. It's like the game of Risk from hell.
And that's the best case scenario. And we still don't know what to make of this. So, and I think that is, you know, everything else aside, there's a lot of nuance here about Mueller had evidence, but not enough evidence to charge for crime one, crime two, crime three. But when you get right down to it, this is a clear-cut case where Trump was offering somebody a pardon, and at a time when he was supposed to be cooperating, he went in and told lies about precisely what went on in this meeting. And as a result, we as Americans don't know what this trade Michigan for carving up Ukraine meeting really was about.
Okay. Well, I think we have to end it on that. But this is an incredible, informative lesson for all of us about that part of the report. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks so much, guys. Yeah.
And, you know, I would say considering we just did 200 pages of report that you've spent hundreds of hours on, thousands of hours, who knows how many hours on. That was a whirlwind tour. That was
your blog is amazing, by the way. Yeah. It's been the most helpful thing through all of this. So. Congrats.
Thanks so
and
much.
Thank you for doing it.
All right.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have any questions for us, please address them to politicspolls@princeton.edu, or you can tweet them at us. I'm at Julian Zelizer.
And I'm at Sam Wang, PhD.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.